Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. From Montpelier to Monticello, Sagamore Hill to Simi Valley, presidential homes and museums offer an often fascinating insight into the private lives of the public men and women whose turns as the nation's first family immortalized them in our nation's history. Some presidential abodes, particularly in the nation's earliest days, were sprawling plantations whose grandeur helped define the new America's architectural sensibilities for decades, and, it bears noting, whose slave quarters helped to define the antebellum Union for modern-day citizens. Others, like Lincoln's Springfield home, were smaller family houses that became intriguing points of study only through the eyes of history, as conservationists and visitors alike search for clues to help unlock the mystery of presidential lives. For many presidents, the homestead has served as a retreat during the White House years and a retirement home after politics, when correspondence and family take precedence. In the modern era, the home has served as a getaway from Washington and permanent political base for presidents like LBJ and George W. Bush. Author Hugh Howard, who lives in nearby East Chatham, which is close to several presidential homes like Grant's Cottage, Martin Van Buren's Lindenwald, and the Calvin Coolidge Historic Site in Vermont, has written extensively on art, history, and architecture. His new book is Houses of the Presidents: Childhood Homes, Family Dwellings, Private Escapes, and Grand Estates, which is published by Little Brown and Company. Hugh Howard, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you, Ray. Nice to be here.
As you were putting this book together, what similarities did you see over the centuries in presidential homes and the way the presidents approached that very private place that would become a public place through history?
I guess I'd say that there are similarities within kind of subcategories, but in general, what you see in presidential homes is an amazing diversity of places. As you just suggested in your intro there, there are these wonderful antebellum mansions like Mount Vernon and Monticello, and there are much more modest places, you know, places like, you know, one that comes immediately to mind is Richard Nixon's birthplace in Yorba Linda, California, which is really little more than a bungalow, a kit house, maybe came from Montgomery Ward, they're not sure, that arrived pre-cut on the back of a railroad car and was turned into a very modest house in a citrus orchard. So the diversity is really quite remarkable.
I was struck in the book by the fact that the presidency has been a great equalizer in many cases. Certainly we had John Quincy Adams, who was a presidential son, and George W. Bush, who was a presidential son, and the homes they came from were, you know, from fairly wealthy families. But there are also people like Bill Clinton, who just came from almost nothing and famously from Hope. And in retrospect, those homes become very interesting, but they rose to the same level as the people who had sort of a leg up in the beginning.
Absolutely. You know, the Clinton house is an interesting case because it wasn't actually his mother's house. His father, Bill Blythe, had died in an automobile crash several months before Bill was born. And so his mother, as a single mom, kind of arrived on her parents' doorstep, having no other options. And so it was a very simple middle-class house in, as you say, Hope, Arkansas, a four-square structure that became his early childhood home. And I think that to understand Clinton, one really gains from seeing him in that house with his mother, with his grandmother, in that modest middle-class circumstance.
How many of the presidential homes are as they were left, and how many have had to be recreated through notes and through correspondence from the time?
You know, I think virtually everyone has benefited from the intervention of preservationists, of curatorial types of people who have invested much energy and research into the task of restoring them. But there were certainly some that were almost immediately turned into historic sites. One that comes to mind is the Woodrow Wilson Retirement Home, which is on S Street in Washington, D.C. He retired there after leaving the presidency in early 1919. He lived out the rest of his life there, which was only four more years. His wife remained for a few more years until her death, but it was designated an historic site essentially from the moment of his death. So that's a case where relatively little changed, where all the collections remained intact. A much more common circumstances where the collections had to be reassembled, and it has proved to be a long and kind of interesting hunt, scavenger hunt in some cases, to recollect those objects.
The notion of a homestead for a president has changed through time. In the early days, there wasn't much campaigning, and they would run for president from the porch. Specifically, James Buchanan comes to mind from your book, having the press and supporters come to him. And then the notion of the house has changed. If you look at our modern day politics, Barack Obama, who's just reelected, was back in his Chicago home for the first time in God knows how long on election night. The way these homes interact with the president's lives has really taken on a different aspect in the modern day.
It certainly has. I think that if you look at somebody like, Reagan is one who comes to mind, the home that has been restored, one of the two Reagan homes, actually, but the principal one that we think of in connection to the Reagan presidency is a ranch north of Santa Barbara, in some ways a not very remarkable adobe structure that was built in the late 19th century by a Mexican immigrant. But it's beautifully situated. It's at the top of an upland canyon. And it's a place that Reagan spent effectively a year of his 8 years in office. He flew there regularly. It was his escape. I think it was a very important place for him in comparison to somebody like Obama, who, as you say, doesn't have the opportunity or hasn't made the opportunity to establish a White House away from the White House in a way that Reagan did, and LBJ, the Texas White House, is another very similar case.
Let's go back in time a bit and tackle Thomas Jefferson, who largely designed his home and set the standard for the way Americans would view what was, you know, in vogue architecturally. What specifically did he have in mind, and what were some of the changes that he brought to bear?
Well, Jefferson, in the simplest possible terms, can be described as a classicist. That is to say, he was extraordinarily fascinated by, in particular, Roman classical architecture, and in fact founded a school of architecture, you might say. When you look back at the history of American architecture, you see various Victorian styles and you see the Greek Revival style. There's a whole category called Jefferson classicism. Monticello is the prototypical example, along with his designs at the University of Virginia. Now, the way he came to that was through his love of books, and he had a very substantial collection of architectural references that he referred to, that he borrowed from, that he cribbed from, if you will, often in his various architectural projects, which were more numerous than simply his house and the University of Virginia. He did projects for friends. He assisted in the design of the Virginia Capitol. But for him, architecture was supposed to make a statement. It was supposed to have a certain grandeur. And his chosen approach to that was columns, entablature, pediments, porticos, the kinds of things that you see on the Parthenon and the Pantheon in the great buildings of classical antiquity. And while we're talking about Jefferson and his architecture, it should also be said that he was Secretary of State to George Washington at the time that it was determined that the nation needed a new capital, a capital that, as we all know, is filled with classical architecture. And that is largely Jefferson's doing, in collaboration with Washington, certainly, but he set the architectural tone for the nation, which we see reflected in banks, in capitals, in farmhouses, in all kinds of buildings across this country.
It should also be noted that Jefferson was one of many of the early presidents who had the main home base, and then also a separate house to escape the visitors who would constantly come through and stay for a night and stay for dinner, which is almost unimaginable for modern day Americans to be able to call on an ex-president at home and stay over.
Yeah, well, it's, Virginian hospitality is justly famous. And it was also a kind of tradition at the time that if someone of a certain class knocked at your door, you would provide them with a meal and an accommodation. Partly that was a practical consideration because when you were traveling by horseback, there were only so many miles that you could cover in a day, 20 or 30, depending upon whether you were driving a carriage or riding a horse. And there were relatively few accommodations. There wasn't a Holiday Inn around every corner. So it was appropriate, and it was a return of a consideration that no doubt you would be offered if you were in someone else's neck of the woods. Now, of course, as a president and as an ex-president, both Washington and Jefferson, and for that matter, James Madison, who lived just up the road a piece from Thomas Jefferson, were wildly popular people that everybody wanted a piece of, if you will. Everybody wanted to have a conversation with these founding fathers, and they made it possible. They were extraordinarily welcoming.
You make the point in the book that architecture played a bit in the James Buchanan election, in that pictures of his home or paintings of his home were distributed as campaign literature in a subtle way of saying, hey, he's kind of like us. In large part, he was elected with Southern sympathies that helped lead to, of course, the Civil War in the next few years. But how important was that to the common person at the time?
I think that in the South, there's little doubt that Buchanan's popularity was enhanced by the notion that he is one of us, that he shares some of our principles, and the appearance of his house, seemingly as a somewhat grand manner, certainly enhanced that sense. One could carry that too far, probably. I think it was really, it had much more to do with his political principles than his architectural tastes.
Okay, let's fast forward to after the Civil War and talk about Ulysses Grant, who spent some time at a critical point at the end of his life in this listening area, fast at work at his memoirs, racing against the cancer in order to try to make some money before he was gone for his heirs. How did he end up at Mount McGregor near Wilton, New York?
Well, he had probably the worst imaginable year of his life, that being the last year. He was a well-to-do man. He'd served two terms in office. He had retired, though there'd been some pressure for him to seek a third term. He traveled in Europe. He'd returned to America and was living just off Fifth Avenue in a very comfortable house, had powerful friends like Jay Gould and the Vanderbilts and others, and had lots of money, not least because his son had gone into partnership with a man named Ferdinand Ward. Unfortunately, Grant and Ward lost all of their money one Monday morning, leaving Grant with the $80 that he had in his pocket.
Amazing.
Because, as it turns out, Ferdinand Ward was the Bernie Madoff of his day. Not very many months later, Grant felt an intense pain in his neck as if someone had just shoved an ice pick into it, and he was diagnosed with throat cancer. So he, impoverished and dying, felt he had to do something for his beloved wife and family, all of whom surrounded him and very much depended upon him. So he sat down to write his memoirs, which he did. He did it over a period of about a year. He had the great good fortune to be friendly with a man named Samuel Clemens, none other than Mark Twain, who came to him and said, I'm founding a publishing company. Wouldn't you like to publish a book with me? And I'll give you 70% of the proceeds. So he struggled to write this book, and having throat cancer, one of his doctors advised him that what he should do is seek a higher elevation away from the heat and climate of New York City. And he went to Wilton, New York, as a guest of a friend, where he found accommodations at the cottage in Wilton. So he was there for the last, I believe, 10 or so weeks of his life. As he finished his memoirs, the personal memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant, which, by the way, proved to be one of the great bestsellers of the 19th century, along with the other book that was published by Mark Twain that year, Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, he got off to a fortuitous start in the publishing game.
He did indeed. He did indeed. And literally 3 days before he died, Ulysses S. Grant put down the manuscript for his book and said, I'm finished.
We're speaking with Hugh Howard, and he's the author of Houses of the Presidents. A more general question for you. How important is the notion of a geographic place to presidential biography, and more importantly, maybe, to a candidate's biography?
Interesting question. You know, surely when it comes to running for office, where you come from has significant significance in a demographic way. We've seen that in the classic examples year in, year out, or when you choose a vice president, you often think, oh, I want to balance the ticket by having, Jack Kennedy chose to have LBJ on his ticket, for example. I think that when it comes to the presidents and whence they come in a more personal way, I think one of the joys of doing this book was to know a little bit of something about each of these presidents and then to wander into their personal places and come away with a better understanding of them as people, as individuals, as men, because, of course, they all have been men. And I think that there are insights to be gained One that comes to mind, a local one that comes to mind, is Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Springwood, wonderful house down in Hyde Park, New York. A couple of interesting things come immediately to mind in thinking about that house. One is that it was a house that he and his mother kind of reinvented in about 1915. Even though Eleanor was on the scene, he and his mother were really partners in the renovation of that house, which is reflected in many of its public spaces. And his mother lived there her entire life and effectively ran the house until her death in 1941, only 4 years before Franklin died. So there's an interesting mother and son dynamic there between Franklin and Sarah Delano Roosevelt. Another thing that comes to mind is, in our time, we think of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a man with a disability because he had polio as a child. Mm-hmm. In his own time, however, when he stood at a podium, and he always stood at a podium, it was plausibly deniable that he had some kind of disability, which he and his political advisors worked very hard to minimize. When you go to Springwood, you see wheelchairs everywhere. Not wheelchairs of the tubular kind that we see today, but converted household chairs, kitchen chairs that have wheels on, not handles to be pushed because he moved them himself, but chairs with wheels on them. And one gets a much more intimate sense of his disability and how it affected his life when you visit Springwood.
Which brings up my next question. Is there, for someone who's studying the history of presidents and the places they lived privately, is there some dissonance in knowing that so much of what a president does in the years after office is for posterity? The letters that went back and forth between Jefferson and so many of the people he had helped found the U.S. with, that certainly comes to mind. And if you go into their homes, in many cases, they're arranged with an eye toward the future visitors to that place. Does that put any complications into what we find there?
Well, I think you have to take a big picture look at each of these presidents in their contexts. And I think there are probably aspects of these houses that do exactly what you suggest, that that kind of shape our perception of them in a way that might not represent their history in a way that they would have done if they hadn't been president, then they hadn't had their eyes on posterity. You put your finger on the classic case, of course, with Adams and Jefferson correspondence, where they spent a dozen odd years writing to one another, but they were writing for a much larger audience. They were writing, they knew perfectly well that these letters would be looked back upon as documents that that were essential to appreciating the founding generation.
And in fact, ended up dying on the exact same day.
They did indeed, July 4th, 1826, 50 years to the day after the issuance of the Declaration of Independence. But these houses have many other interesting bits and pieces that that are reflective of different moments earlier in their lives. I mean, a case like the JFK birthplace in Brookline, Massachusetts, that reflects John Kennedy's legacy in a kind of unusual way because it was restored by his mother, by Rose Kennedy, after his death. He was killed in November of 1963, of course, and her family purchased the house, restored it, and gifted it to the National Park Service half a dozen years later. But it was done in a way that reflects more her recollections of what his boyhood was like than any kind of scholarly approach. So there's this kind of warm, friendly narrative that is offered literally in vocal terms as a tape that plays Rose's voice that takes you on a tour of the house. But that said, it's hardly a complete view because, among other things, she restored the house with essentially no objects that connect to her Catholicism, though her faith was fundamental to her. So there are no crucifixes. There's also no mention of the fact that they had two servants who lived upstairs. Now, I think that's a reflection of her perception that her family, still a very active political family in the 1960s, with her son Robert, who was alive, with her son Teddy, obviously, and Catholicism was regarded as something of a political liability, so she left that out of the picture. And further, the notion of having servants, the Kennedys were seen by some as spoiled little rich boys. So even though they were very much middle-class kids when they were in that house, they left the servant piece out in the 1960s because it reflected something that she didn't want people to think about her sons.
And that's a major issue for many of the early presidents who owned slaves, where the slave quarters are located, how much a part of the story they become. Everyone knows the Jefferson story, but, you know, this continued throughout the 1800s.
It, you know, up until the Civil War, it was very much a presence. You know, it's one of the very complicating aspects of looking back at some of these certifiably great men like Washington, who did actually free his slaves in his will. James Madison, I mean, he was the principal pen behind the Constitution. He owned slaves. Andrew Jackson, you know, the sort of first classic man of the people president, he had slaves, and he wasn't so kind to Native Americans either.
And he didn't free his slaves either at the end.
No, the only one who did was George Washington. And in fact, George Washington only did half the job because he couldn't free his wife's slaves because they were entailed to her estate over which he had no direct control.
I don't mean this to sound as political as it will sound, just a caveat there. Would Mitt Romney have had the most presidential homes had he won this past election for you to write about?
I wonder. Somebody wrote me the other day saying, well, it's good that he didn't win because it would have been very difficult to take a picture of his car elevator.
Well, listen, Hugh Howard, the author of Houses of the Presidents, Childhood Homes, Family Dwellings, Private Escapes, and Grand Estates, the book is published by Little Brown & Company. It has been such a pleasure to talk to you about this project, and thanks for coming in and seeing us.
Thank you kindly for inviting me.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.